What does the surging price of corn mean for you and me?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, the 12th of October. We've been telling you a lot lately about booming commodities, and here's another one. Corn is roughly as high as an elephant's eye, and it's time to find out more with our Tuesday morning regular, analyst Julie Neiman at Smith Moore & Company, joining us from St. Louis. Hi, Julie.
Morning, Bill.
The Agriculture Department said this year's corn crop will come in low. Now the price of corn is at a two-year high. How's that going to ripple through the economy?
Well, it's a huge problem because we had flooding early and it washed out all the nitrogen, so it's looking pretty puny in Iowa and Illinois. And then we had huge heat later and that popped all the corn in Kansas. That means we're going to have higher costs going through the entire economy because the crop yield and the demand is huge, simply isn't there.
So higher prices at the supermarket. What about the government's role in all this, Julie?
Well, we have a huge export market going on, but Russia has a severe drought, so they banned all the grain exports, and China buys a lot of our crop. They have a huge demand as well. We're going to have to cut back on there unless they want to increase the prices. The biggest problem we're faced with now is the lobby is a lot stronger for the corn and ethanol producers than it is for the food producers. So you're going to see the diversion of what corn crop is left over to ethanol because fuel is more of a requirement, and you're going to see the corn growers not putting it into feedstocks. Now, the problem with the cattle, they can eat other alternative grains, but those have all gone up as well. So it's going to hurt the ranchers, it's going to raise food prices, and it's going to hurt the export markets as well.
Very interesting. Analyst Julie Neiman joining us from Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis. Thank you, Julie.
You bet.
And you can't have corn without water. H2O is another commodity that is projected to get more scarce. Industries that rely heavily on water are trying to adapt. Now, a beer company has come up with the idea of a floating brewery. The BBC's Rebecca Singer has more.
Making beer uses a lot of water. More than a gallon of H2O is needed on average to make just one quart of beer. But a recent study estimates the amount of water available across the globe could fall by 40% in the next 20 years. So the brewer of Miller Beer has been looking at ways it could carry on its business in those circumstances. Andy Wales is the head of sustainable development at SAB Miller and says a brewery on a ship is a realistic option.
You'd plug it in at a dock and you'd get water. You'd be able to plug it into energy, or you might even be able to use things like solar power or wind or other energy sources on the ship. And then you brew beer, bottle it, and send it out into the local market.
Wales says it could also be moved between different countries, which would be particularly useful in reaching new customers and adapting to seasonal demand. And if there's not enough local water available, then the ship would also be able to use desalinated ocean water. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
Pfizer said this morning it has agreed to buy King Pharmaceuticals of Tennessee for $3.6 billion in cash. King specializes in pain medication. Well, this week, the big pharmacy benefits company, Express Scripts, rolled out a program that's designed to predict who might stop taking their medicines and contact those people before they stop. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that.
Express Scripts is applying behavioral science to healthcare. Bob Neese is the company's chief scientist. He says the pill skippers include those of us with kids at home.
Having a routine that you follow every day gets disrupted much more easily.
I'll say.
My 18-month-old twins have gleefully ripped my routine to shreds. Neese says everyone under age 45 is less likely to take their medicine. Express Scripts combs through prescriptions to find who skips refills. Then the company calls them or sends a text. Leighton Koo teaches health policy at George Washington University. He says insurers could save money.
This can help reduce the cost for things like being hospitalized, lots of visits to specialists.
Koo says the health care reform law outlaws lifetime limits on coverage, so insurers are especially interested in prevention. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, October 12th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, Please go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Now, the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world. Police in Hungary have arrested the director of an aluminum company that sent a deadly flood of poison sludge into the Hungarian countryside. Meantime, Hungary's parliament has voted to take control of the company. The BBC's Duncan Kennedy joins us. Tell us how authorities are dealing with the problem. Duncan, go on.
Well, there are a couple of things going on. Those police are continuing to question the boss of MAL over things like endangering public safety and causing damage to the environment. And the government here, as you said, has stepped in to take over the temporary running of this business. At the same time, they reckon they'll complete this emergency dam in the next few hours. And I have to tell you, Bill, it's a massive thing, nearly a mile long and as high as a small house. And they think that even if the reservoir wall caves in again, as it did a week ago, this dam will be able to trap what comes out.
And Duncan, how quickly will people affected be able to go back home?
Well, they reckon that people in the main village, worst hit, can get into their homes by Friday. But I have to tell you, when I was in the village a day or so ago, we saw living rooms with 2 inches of sludge still in them. I also saw someone's wardrobe full of this toxic slurry and even a woman's handbag coated in it. So there's still a lot of cleaning up to do. There's also a ton of dust in the air because it's hot here and the sludge is drying out. So people are being told they must wear their masks. They've also been doing more checks on rivers nearby, and they're much cleaner. But this whole tragedy isn't over yet, as we're expecting the first funerals of the 8 people who died to begin in the next few days. Bill?
That's the BBC's Duncan Kennedy. Duncan, thank you. Some of the UK's biggest media groups have joined forces against Rupert Murdoch. They're urging the British government to block Murdoch's latest corporate media maneuver. We get that story from Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London.
This is an unprecedented alliance. The publicly owned BBC has joined with major newspapers both on the left and right of British politics. Together, they're urging the government to consider blocking Rupert Murdoch's latest plan. The tycoon aims to take full control over satellite broadcaster BSky B. He wants to buy the 61% he doesn't already own. Murdoch currently controls about one-third of the UK's newspaper market. George Brock is Professor of Journalism at City University in London. He says Murdoch's British rivals are getting nervous.
He is a very powerful figure, and there will be plenty of people in this argument who will say he's quite powerful enough, he shouldn't get any more powerful, and the law should be used to limit that power.
Today's call to block Murdoch's move is a political headache for the government. The ruling Conservatives came to power with the support of Britain's best-selling newspaper, The Sun, owned by Rupert Murdoch. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Pakistan's finance minister is in the U.S. today. He's talking to the World Bank about how to handle foreign aid sent to help victims of Pakistan's recent flooding. Foreign aid is also the subject of today's Marketplace Globalist Quiz with our quizmaster, Stefan Richter. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning, Bill. Are you ready for today's question?
I think so.
All right. Bill, we know that foreign aid is a very touchy subject. And my question to you is, which country provides the most development aid as a share of GDP so that we get some sense, not absolute dollar numbers, but X percent of GDP? Which one does the most among these countries? The home champion, the United States, Germany, Norway, or Sweden? Who does best and most?
That's the tricky part. Compared to GDP, I'm going to say Europe is volatile. Germany's a leader there, so Germany's handing out the most aid.
Germany is a leader, but not the leader. You're right that the Europeans in general do quite well. But Germany comes in second, so you are very close, but need to ask you to guess again.
I'll say even given our huge economy, the U.S. has such an interest in the world order that the U.S. leads the way.
Oh! It does in some sense, in terms of the absolute number of dollars. But I asked about GDP, yeah. So the U.S. spends $27 billion on development assistance, but that with our large economy only translates into close to 0.2% of our GDP.
Norway? Got to be Norway, obviously. Why are we even having this discussion?
Because you were going to say Sweden. I mean, the one thing that's pretty clear is that the Scandinavians always do very well on these things. like development aid and on gender issues and performance and so on. But it's a toss-up. I'll give you Norway is quite close, but it's third. Sweden is tops. Almost 1% of its GDP is spent on development aid, as does Denmark, as does the Netherlands and Norway. They are sort of up there leading the way for all of us to reach.
If I could say utter failure in Swedish, I would. So I'll just say thank you, Stefan.
Yeah, it's probably something like Akvavitskol or something, right?
Indeed. Stefan Richter is publisher and editor-in-chief of The Globalist. And you can learn more about the world economy, politics, and culture by visiting theglobalist.com. You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, October 12th. I'm Bill Radke. If you want to know what the markets are doing, just hop over to the numbers at marketplace.org. Google's latest investment will help it power all those server farms that make billions of searches possible. The tech giant announced plans on its blog to build an underground power transmission system along the eastern seaboard. And we're going to learn more about that now from reporter Janet Babin. Hello, Janet.
Good morning, Bill.
What is the scope of this project?
Well, it sounds pretty big. According to Google's blog, the idea is to build these transmission lines, some 350 miles of them, from New Jersey to Virginia. And the goal being that these cables would eventually transport energy made from wind turbines off the coast to some 2 million households. Now, the East Coast is a potential powerhouse of wind energy, but no one's tapped it yet because Google says because of the lack of a secure transmission system, right? That's a big infrastructure project, very expensive. And Google says this investment will help remove those barriers and could also alleviate grid congestion that's been a big problem along the East Coast.
Janet, aren't there groups that oppose building wind turbines in the ocean?
There are, but Google plans to build these cables, or not build it, but to fund these cables so that they can be built far enough away from the coast, about 15 to 20 miles, so that they could tap into wind turbines that would be built far out as well. So 15 or 20 miles from the coast, probably you wouldn't be able to see them or hear them.
And did Google say whether some of this energy would power those server farms I mentioned?
No, it didn't mention that, Bill, but Google searches do add up to lots of energy use. I mean, according to Nielsen, there were about 10 billion Google searches in the U.S. alone in March of this year. So by some estimates, a typical Google search consumes 0.3 energy watt hours. That's like 1.8 billion watt hours consumed on Google searches. Yeah, that's a lot of energy.
Very interesting. Excellent math. Janet Babin reporting live. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now to the Windy City. This week, Chicago Mayor Richard Daley is due to lay out his plans for fixing the city's record $655 million budget shortfall. He's expected to pay for it in part by dipping into the city's reserves. And that is not sitting well with everyone, as Chicago Public Radio's Tony Arnold reports.
Chicago's city council caused quite a stir back in December 2008 when it leased its parking meters to a private company and got more than $1 billion up front. But for the next 75 years, nothing. At the time, Mayor Richard Daley justified the deal as a creative solution in troubled times.
As the economy gets worsening, this will become a very, very challenging for us to make sure the budget is balanced every year.
But the recession continued. Now the mayor wants to use the parking meter money to help plug the city's record budget deficit. Kent Redfield is a political science professor with the University of Illinois.
Long-term leases, particularly if they're driven by short-term budget problems, may not serve the interests of the citizens.
Daley's announced he won't stand for re-election in February after 20 years in office. The next mayor may want to think carefully before leasing other city assets. In Chicago, I'm Tony Arnold from Marketplace.
Voters in parts of Maryland will be deciding next month whether to allow construction of a casino next to a mall. Reporter Kathy Duchamp looks into whether slot machines and shopping are a good fit.
This is the Arundel Mills Mall. It's about halfway between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. Right now, this place is all about shopping. There are outlet stores galore. I'm looking at The Gap, American Eagle. But if developer Joe Weinberg gets his way, we'll be able to walk out the food court doors here, across a parking lot, and into a slots casino with 4,700 machines.
we would expect that the Arundel Mills facility will be one of the top grossing casinos anywhere in the country.
Weinberg is development chief for Baltimore-based Cordish Companies. He's convinced slots and shopping are a good combination. That's based on revenue from a casino and retail complex his company built in Florida. Weinberg expects the state of Maryland could net close to $500 million a year in tax revenue from a casino at the Arundel Mills Mall.
If you look at the average profile of the casino gambler, the average spend will be somewhere between $50 and $100 per visit, which is not too different than going to a movie and out for dinner.
But the mall casino mashup faces opposition.
I think there has to be a better place to put a casino where there are no families and residential homes around it.
The project is much too large to go into a mall parking lot.
That's a TV ad produced by a group fighting the plan. The campaign is mostly financed by owners of a horse racing track that's 10 miles away. They want a casino there. The owners wouldn't talk, but clearly stand to lose business if the mall casino project moves forward. Trip McCoy is an analyst with the firm Heller Gaming and Leisure. He says battles over where casinos belong will continue across the country.
More and more states are facing wider and wider budget deficits. So our expectation is that you're going to only see more and more proliferation.
The American Gaming Association reports as of today, 38 states have some form of casino gambling. I'm Kathy Duchamp for Marketplace.
There is a salon hair straightening treatment that I'm just learning about called the Brazilian Blowout. It costs $250 and up, and apparently celebrities really dig it. But recently, researchers concluded the product contains a lot of formaldehyde. The company responded, no, there's no formaldehyde. And then later it responded, well, maybe a little bit of formaldehyde. Some salons are offering overhead ventilation machines to cut down on the headaches, nosebleeds, burning eyes, and respiratory problems. Or experts recommend you just use a blow dryer and flat iron, or just have curly hair. And finally, congratulations, but be careful. A new study concludes 92% of American children under the age of 2 have an online presence, one I might add that they did not ask for. You know how this goes. Mom or dad posts on Facebook or emails a birth announcement with the kid's first, middle, and last name, often the mother's maiden name, birth date, of course. Friends forward that stuff to friends of friends, and all of this makes identity thieves light a cigar in celebration. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.